This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. Senator Sam Ervin served as North Carolina's senator from 1954 until 1974. And for about the first 19 of his 20 years of office, he was not widely known nationally. But Watergate changed that. In the summer and fall of 1973, 30 years ago, Sam Ervin chaired the Senate Watergate Committee. He came to the job with more than a working knowledge of the Constitution. He carried a copy of it in his pocket. And from his center stage seat on that panel, Sam Ervin combined a down-home manner with a tenaciousness to get to the bottom of the break-in. And in so doing, Sam Ervin became one of President Richard Nixon's sworn enemies. The evidence can be heard in one of the president's own Oval Office recordings.
They don't realize what they're up against, this stupid Ervin drinking too much and pointing his finger.
That's right. That's right.
Because one day I'm going to attack that committee, and when I do, it's going to be a blockbuster. I'm going to take it apart like it's never been taken apart.
Exactly.
I really will.
But the hearings, the Watergate hearings, ended up taking apart the president. As for Senator Sam Ervin, he remains best known for chairing that Watergate committee. But he was also a constitutional scholar, a dogged defender of privacy rights, one of the most effective representatives North Carolina has ever known, and one of the more vehement opponents of civil rights legislation. In the end, Senator Sam was much more than the country lawyer he claimed to be. And on this, the 30th anniversary of the Watergate hearings, we're remembering Senator Sam Ervin on The State of Things today. With us are Rufus Edmiston, former North Carolina Attorney General, North Carolina Secretary of State, and he was also the Deputy Chief Counsel for the Senate Watergate Committee and an aide to Sam Ervin, and he's here in the studio. Welcome, Rufus Edmiston.
Hello, Melinda.
And Dr. Carl Campbell is with us. He is Assistant Professor of History at Appalachian State University and an expert on Watergate and Senator Sam Ervin. Welcome, Carl Campbell.
Good morning.
And we welcome your calls this hour as well. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. That's toll-free, 1-877-962-9862. Email address, sot@wunc.org. Well, Rufus Edmiston, I'd like to start with you. 30 years ago today, on the 23rd of October, 1973, Richard Nixon said he would comply with the subpoenas and turn over to the Watergate Committee some of the tape recordings made in his office. I understand that was a subpoena that you had delivered a few months earlier.
That's correct. It was a very unusual day because we had just discovered that the tapes existed, and everybody thought the president would give them up right away. We thought, well, my goodness, you can't possibly hold on to these tapes. And so I had sort of angled to take the subpoena down there because I knew the historical significance of it. And it was quite a day. I had a police escort. There must have been 200 or 300 newspaper people there. And I walked up to the executive office building. And Professor Charles Allen Wright, I'm sure Dr. Campbell will recognize that name, and Leonard Garment, he was sort of the counsel of the week. You know, Nixon would get rid of a counsel and move on to the next one. And I delivered the subpoena to them, not personally to the president, and they were not very happy about it, I'll say that. But it was an absolutely incredible day.
And that was in July of 1973.
It was close around there, yes.
Yeah, it took a couple of months. It went to the Supreme Court, whether he had to do that, didn't it?
Correct.
Turn over those tapes. You have that subpoena to this day?
I have that subpoena now. I don't want people to think that I pilfered it. Dr. Campbell, I just conveniently left the committee and the president copies of it. But I have willed it to the University of North Carolina. But I have it in my office, and if anyone would love to come see it sometime, I would welcome them. I've got quite a good Watergate Committee museum over there.
So let me get this straight. You did not give the president, you did not give the White House the actual subpoena, you gave him copies?
Well, I had copies when I went down there, and I just happened to keep the original one myself.
I wonder if it still has standing, if it was a copy.
Oh, no. Very, very much so. Very much so.
We're talking about Senator Sam Ervin today. Rufus Edmiston is with us, and Dr. Carl Campbell, who is working on a biography of the senator and the chairman of the Senate Watergate Committee, which happened 30 years ago today. Carl Campbell, tell us what it was that made Senator Sam Ervin become the chairman of that committee. How was it that he was chosen?
Well, there really weren't a lot of other possibilities from a political reality. Mike Mansfield was looking at the options. People like Senator Kennedy were thinking of running for president, others who were interested. Sam Ervin was not going to be running for president. He was respected on both sides of the aisle. He had this reputation as being a constitutional expert. But I think something a lot of people don't realize is that Sam Ervin and Richard Nixon had been at war since the very first week of Nixon's first administration. So there was a context there that there was a natural for Mansfield to choose Irvin.
What was the nature of that war?
Well, if you begin it, I think it was 11 days after Nixon took the office that he declared that he was going to pass the District of Columbia Crime Bill. And this bill would have taken away the civil liberties of many Americans, a no-knock entry by the police, preventative detention, in other words, the right to bail would be withheld. That's because there was a lot of fear. There was a war on crime, and Nixon was going to do something about it. And Sam Irvin, the old constitutionalist, immediately took to the Senate floor and said, this cannot be. From that point on, the committee that Mr. Edmondson was involved in and the Separation of Powers Committee, Constitutional Rights Committee, it was a growing war right up until Watergate.
Oh, I remember that so well, Carl. The president had this penchant for wanting to make things simple. Senator Irvin used to say so many times, you know, the fellow's afraid of freedom. Hmm. And he just repeated it over and over again, the fellow's afraid of freedom. And also, Carl, I'm sure you remember, too, that Nixon commenced this program of wanting the military to commit surveillance over civilians. Now, that was a horrible thing to Sam Irvin. I would be with him so many times alone, and he would just almost have apoplexy because he couldn't understand how anybody who had grown up in America could want to do those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
There's an irony, though, because it was actually Richard Nixon who swore Sam Irvin into office back in 1954.
That's right. And it was an interesting time when Irvin went to the Senate. Irvin was appointed. He was on the North Carolina Supreme Court when he got the call from his friend and Governor Umstead. He went to Washington right at the time of the Brown decision and the McCarthy hearings, both of which Irvin became involved in. So there he was in Washington, and across, it's a wonderful picture. There's Richard Nixon holding the Bible, and Sam Irvin is being sworn on. They're looking at each other eye to eye. Quite an irony.
Yeah, but at that time, there was no cause for animosity between the two?
None at all. No, they hardly knew each other and actually didn't have many dealings together until 68.
Well, Rufus Edmondson, many people in the country have that image of Sam Irvin from the Senate Watergate Committee. He was literally center stage, right in the center of that panel of the committee, looking out at the witnesses. And there's that image of his eyebrows wagging, the glasses perched on his nose, moving as he spoke. But you had a different perspective, because you were often right beside him, just aft of him. What is the lasting image you have? What's the vivid memory you have of Sam Irvin at those hearings?
Well, my memory is not so much the hearings. It's all those wonderful times I spent with him alone in a car for hours, traveling with him, staying in the same room with him, having a little bourbon and ginger ale, as he used to call it, his bourbon and ginger ale, every night. And to know that the man had nothing about him that was pretentious. We'd get the letters that came in during Watergate were either lovingly wonderful or they were extremely hateful, and we were getting thousands of pieces of mail a week. And people didn't seem to understand that Senator Irvin didn't care what people thought of him as long as he was following what he thought was the right thing to do under the Constitution. That's what I like so much about him, that he never wavered. And I want to clear something up here right quickly, that I never in my entire career of living virtually daily with the man for 10 years ever heard him utter one prejudicial word about any race or anybody's ethnicity. When he was fighting the civil rights bills you mentioned a moment ago, Melinda, he was fighting them on the grounds that he thought that they were not constitutional. And I just want to make that very plain in this broadcast right away.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit about that, Carl Campbell. Tell me more about this. But why did Sam Irvin oppose civil rights legislation, the Civil Rights Act, et cetera, I mean, to the end of his career, as I understand, in the U.S. Senate? What were some of those measures, first of all, and what was his basis for opposing it?
Well, from the time he arrived in the Senate and opposed the Brown decision, as a matter of fact, he helped
to write
the...
That's Brown versus Board of Education, right?
Yeah, yes. And and he helped to write the Southern Manifesto, which was the South statement against the Brown decision, and he never voted for a civil rights bill, at least for African Americans, for 20 years. Now, there's two historical views here. The one view is that Sam Irvin was a traditional 19th century liberal, that he was consistent. As Irvin would say, it's not the civil rights of some, but the civil liberties of all. on which I take my stand. And Irvin was against big government, and he just didn't see the need to for the federal government to pass more laws to give special rights to African Americans. Now, the other historical view, however, is that mostly Irvin's critics and civil rights activists have pointed out that he wasn't always consistent, and they saw him as a using the Constitution as a convenient cloak for his political or racist ideas. And I kind of think both sides are a little bit wrong. In my work on Irvin, I use Irvin himself. He told the story about a man who turned 95 years of age in Morganton, and the reporters went up and said, "Wow, you've lived a long time. You must have seen a lot of changes in your life." And the old man said, "Yep, and I've been against every darn one of them." And I think in many ways that's what Sam Irvin was. He was a man who believed in the Constitution and the traditional Southern way of life, and as a true gentleman tried to defend that throughout his career.
Mm-hmm. Did he catch any flack for this at the time of the Watergate hearings? Did that come up about his votes against civil rights? Or
not really too much during Watergate that I recall or that I've seen in the literature. It's kind of funny, instead of looking at Irvin, to look at the American public. You know, Sam Irvin told wonderful stories, and some of the stories he told against civil rights people didn't think were very funny. But when he told the exact same stories against Richard Nixon, we laughed pretty hard.
Oh, yeah. As I'm sure Dr. Campbell knows, that one of Irvin's great assets was his ability to use humor to diffuse great fights.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava, and today we're talking about Senator Sam Irvin Jr., who served as the Democratic senator in North Carolina from 1954 to 1974, and perhaps achieved greater fame nationally as the chairman of the Senate Watergate hearings in 1973. That's 30 years ago, this summer and this fall. I'm going to play a cut right now to give us a flavor of what it sounded like then. We have here Senator Sam Irvin talking about what he saw Watergate, how he saw it fitting into the nation's history.
I deeply regret that this situation has arisen, because I think that the Watergate tragedy is the greatest tragedy this country has ever suffered. I used to think that the Civil War was our country's greatest tragedy, but I do remember that there were some redeeming features in the Civil War, in that there was some spirit of sacrifice and heroism displayed on both sides. I see no redeeming features in Watergate.
Senator Sam Irvin of North Carolina speaking as he chaired the Senate Watergate hearings in 1973. With us this hour talking about Sam Irvin are Rufus Edmiston, who had been deputy chief counsel for the Senate Watergate Committee and a longtime aide to Sam Irvin. He's also the former attorney general and secretary of state here in North Carolina. And Dr. Carl Campbell is assistant professor of history at Appalachian State University and an expert on Watergate and Sam Irvin. Carl Campbell, what in Sam Irvin's background prepared him for this role?
You almost have to go back a couple generations. The way, you know, men like Sam Irvin took their personal histories and brought them into their breast and lived with them through their lives. And Irvin came from a line of Presbyterian Scots-Irishmen who had historically fought against the King of England and had fought for justice and liberty. Irvin, as a young man, was taken to the Supreme Court by his father, and he idolized the institution and the law. And, of course, he was an excellent constitutional lawyer. Many people don't know that Sam Irvin went to Harvard Law School, the old country lawyer, but he went through backwards.
Now explain that.
Well, Sam Irvin went to Harvard, and he was in love with Ms. Margaret, who he wanted to marry, so he only took the last year of classes. But then Ms. Margaret said that he could have another year, so he took the second year of classes, and she said, "Oh, go ahead and finish up." So he took the first year of classes, and he's the only person who's known to have gone through Harvard Law School backwards.
Rufus Edmiston, you've been through law school. What is that like? You're taking the more complex courses first and then
well,
the basics?
Which way did you go, Rufus?
Carl, I went the traditional way while working with Senator Irvin, and I went at nighttime, and I said, "I now know." No, Senator Irvin said to me, "You now know the meaning of cruel and unusual punishment going to law school." And one other time, too, he was arguing a case before the Supreme Court as a senator for Darlington Mills, and senators used to do that occasionally, those that had enough legal sense to do it. And so I carried over this huge armful of books with him to the Supreme Court, and he says, "Now, Rufus, you know the weight of the law." And I'll never forget that. The tremendously wonderful fellow. And by the way, back that time, Carl, as you know, you read law, and you could. He had already passed the North Carolina bar when he went to Harvard backwards. So that's how that worked.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go to Mike in Raleigh. Hi there, Mike. Oh, hello. Hi, Mike.
Yes,
greetings. Hi. Welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you. I just wanted to call. I had the privilege of growing up next door to Senator Sam in Morganton as a child. And basically there was a whole enclave of Irvin children, his grandchildren, around his house. And I played with them. And whenever Senator Sam came home, we would all go bouncing over to see him. And basically what you saw on TV was exactly what you got when you met him every day. He would always, you know, be friendly to us and tell us stories and give us candy. And was just a wonderful man and held very much in high regard by everyone in Morganton.
Oh.
Well, Mike, that's great. I was probably there with him when you were over sometime. I hope I met you.
Well, I think you might actually have been. I remember some times when you were in town, and, you know, the whole Irvin family was just held in tremendously high regard by everyone. And when Senator Sam became chairman of the Watergate Committee, everyone in Morganton just felt like, well, that, what else do you expect? That's the way it should have been. So we all were very happy having our native son being shared with the rest of the country.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mike, thank you so much for your call.
Sure, thank you.
You know, Sam Irvin passed himself off as a mere country lawyer. That was the image he sometimes liked to project. It seemed like he was downplaying his skills a lot there. But if you go back over his career, he spent most of his career outside of Morganton.
Oh, he spent... Yeah. All of his career in the law. He never did anything else that I know of except the law. And Howard Baker one time said, yeah, his being a country lawyer brings to mind that you should put your hand on your billfold when there's a thief around. And he did spend most of his time out because he was, you have to make a choice somewhere along in life where you're going to be in public service. And as Carl knows, it ran deep in his blood about being a public servant. And I'm sure that Senator Irvin could have been a general counsel for the large corporate interests, this and that. He chose not to do that. And he never amassed a great amount of wealth because you don't do that if you're in politics.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But we should recap his career. He was an attorney in Morganton. Then he goes to the state legislature. One of the things he did there when he was serving a couple of terms in the state legislature in the 40s, I believe it was, Carl Campbell?
Well, no, actually, first in the 1920s.
In the 20s.
And he was there during the debate over whether Darwin should be taught in the public schools. And it was a major debate just before the Scopes trials happened in Tennessee. And Sam Irvin, using his humor and showing his courage and commitment to civil liberties, even though he was a very young man, stood up in the debate and used a joke, said, you know, the only thing passing a law that keeps Darwin out of the textbooks and the schools will do is to absolve monkeys for responsibility for the human race.
Yes.
He was a very courageous man, even in the 1920s. He also, it's important to notice, pushed forward legislation and passed legislation to increase spending for African American schools in Burke County. And I think that very much shows the kind of a traditional paternalism that North Carolina had. He was genuinely concerned about all of his constituents, even though at the same time he believed in a segregated society. And in his early career in the 20s, he showed that. Now, it is interesting that in the 1940s, a lot of people don't know that Sam Irvin did serve in the House of Representatives for 1 year. It was a tragic story. The real politician in the Irvin family was his younger brother. His younger brother had a terrible bone disease in his leg that he had gotten from falling from a tree as a child. And his brother was in Congress and tragically committed suicide right at Christmas. And Sam Irvin was sent to Washington, absolutely hated the year, said he never wanted to have anything more to do with politics, and he never really wanted to. He was absolutely delighted serving in the North Carolina Supreme Court until he was tapped to go to the Senate.
And then, so the times that he got into Congress, the initial times as a congressman and then as a senator, he was appointed both times.
That's correct.
Correct. But he sure got elected more times after his appointment to the Senate.
Yeah, and you did a lot of campaigning with him, Rufus
Houston. Oh, yeah. And I was there was some article the other day in the Charlotte Observer where they were talking about the campaigns today, and they called me and asked me, what was it like to campaign with Irvin? Well, I think we really had, Carl, one of the last old-fashioned campaigns. We'd get in this old ramshackled Chrysler of his that was sort of like the Ship of Fools bouncing around over the road. And we would literally go from courthouse to courthouse, and I would sort of call ahead and get the sheriff to round up the clerk of court and the registrar of deeds and folks like that. And you went in, you shook their hands, you'd have a rally that night somewhere in an armory. And you had done your job, and God forbid that Irvin would have ever engaged in some of these negative ads that go on today. We did a little bit of radio, and you literally had participatory democracy back then, unlike today.
Mm-hmm. Right. I understand that in his last campaign, which would have been 1968 for the Senate, he spent the grand sum of $30,000?
Well, he collected that, and he gave a bunch of it back.
Well, we had, the other day on our program, we had Congressman Richard Burr, who is planning to run for the U.S. Senate next year, Republican running for the Senate, and he said he thought it was going to take in the neighborhood of $15
million. Oh, yeah. It's well, that last year was 68, mm-hmm. and I remember sitting there, Senator Irvin said, well, I got to send this money back, so he proportionally sent back to everyone who gave him a contribution the amount that he had not mm-hmm. spent, and he only spent about two-thirds of that $30,000. And, of course, today things are just obscene. It's just absolutely a race for money. There's nothing akin to democracy about the way we run today, and I was in that race myself. I ran statewide 11 times. Until we do something about the incredible amounts of money, then we're not going to get democracy back.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. And I think this is an important point in understanding Sam Irvin. I mean, Sam Irvin was born in 1896. There was not electricity to his home. He had just gotten plumbing. There were no radios. And he remembers the first car coming to Morganton. And this is a man who later is on an IBM computer, a television icon, where people are seeing him in this technological age of the 1970s. I mean, he really does bring to us on television an earlier age. And I think that was what was significant about Irvin. He's a disaster on television. He sputters and he pauses. And I mean, today I don't know what managers would do with a politician like that, but he was so real. Almost like Shakespeare, like a low reality principle, a Falstaffian character, that he was perfect to bring the kind of truth and old-fashioned integrity, sputtering as it was, versus the slick, blue-eyed, well-dressed young bureaucrats in the White House.
Could it be that the Senate Watergate hearings were just the perfect setting for that? Because the nation was wrapped. People were stopping what they were doing to watch what was going on for long spans of time, if you hear lots of people talking about what it was like 30 years ago. And, even in 1973, the nightly news would not let people run on for a minute and a half with a sound bite.
Mm-hmm.
But you have Sam Irvin. He is dead center in the middle of that hearing at center stage, and he could go on. I mean, was it a matter of this mix of the time and the place and the setting?
You know, sometimes you just see the right man at the right time, and it was. But I'd like to analyze that just a pinch further. A lot of historians talk about the southernization of American politics. If you think about the 1960s, a politician with a southern accent was spurned or laughed at. But right there in the 1970s, there's a transition where Southerners and Southern political culture begins to take over the nation. And Sam Irvin is one of the key figures with his accent, his warm truthfulness, his genuineness. And then you get Jimmy Carter, and now we almost don't have a national politician that doesn't have a Southern accent running for president.
Right.
Yeah, well, the good thing about Watergate was that you didn't have the 10-second soundbite media advisors The Watergate episode was so significant that the TVs ran it. Now, I don't think they would run an hour of anything today unless the war were coming to an end, but it allowed Irvin to escape what the horrors are today of the 10-second soundbite boys.
Let's go to Roger in Durham. Hi there, Roger. Welcome to the State of Things.
Hi there. I was going to school in Pennsylvania at the time, and I'll tell you, everybody waited to hear the next syllable that Sam Irvin would sputter, and it was like the O.J. trial for our generation. It was riveting. I was just wondering if you could refresh my memory on the atmosphere and dialogue that took place when the mention of tapes was brought up.
When John Dean first mentioned that there might be tapes that the White House was recording.
Yeah, I can tell you the defining moment, of course, when we always had individuals who were to appear on TV in private session the day before in this little dungeon-like place. It's like the lawyers, you know, the old story about the lawyers don't ask the question unless you know what the answer is. And Butterfield was, I wasn't in the room that time, but I remember so distinctly we were out at a party at Senator Herman Talmadge's house, and somebody came and told me, said, hey, look, this guy Butterfield said that there's a taping system in the White House. He just told, it was a rather minor counsel that asked the question of Butterfield. And I told Senator Ervin, and I never forget, his eyebrows almost lapped the ground. And I'm not going to say to whom he made reference. He says, but don't tell Senator so-and-so, because he knew he'd leak it immediately. And so I went and told Senator Baker, and that was the only secret that we kept for a while until the next day. And of course, in the hearings, not every senator knew what was going to be brought forth that day. And it was just electrifying. See, the whole atmosphere in Washington was electrifying. Everywhere you went, everybody was clutched to Watergate. And it wasn't only those who are interested in politics. You had mechanics with the radios on listening to the Watergate hearings. You had folks that you'd never dream of getting interested in. And we had dramas being played out all the time with amateur mystery solvers. Thousands and thousands of letters. I'm sure that Carl sometime will go through some of those, but I had five people on the staff to do nothing but handle the mail.
Yeah, yeah. We are talking with Rufus Edmiston and Carl Campbell about Sam Ervin, who 30 years ago this summer and fall was chairman of the Senate Watergate Committee. And that introduced the nation to Sam Ervin. He had been a North Carolina senator for almost 20 years at that point. What do you think, Carl Campbell, Sam Ervin would make of some of the issues we are dealing with today? What would he make of the Patriot Act?
Oh, my. Well, I'll begin with the caveat that we historians are always a little more comfortable looking backwards than forwards. But that being said, I don't think that any historian would disagree with me when I say that Sam Ervin would be in hysteria.
Carl, he would be not turning his grave. He would be spinning.
Yeah, they're... You have to remember that Sam Ervin had been fighting for civil liberties and privacy 10 years before Watergate. For instance, a specific example, in 1969, the Nixon Treasury Department secretly began to ask librarians to reveal the lending list of certain people that were suspicious, and Ervin publicized that and held hearings on it. Now, I don't want to take this too far, because in the 1950s, Sam Ervin was an avid anti-communist, and I think he would support many of the provisions of the Patriot Act, especially if the courts, and there was a sense of checks and balances within, which there is not always, but Sam Ervin would absolutely be appalled at the direction that we're going today.
What would he have made of giving President Bush more or less a free hand in going to war in Iraq? Of not having debate as we got closer to the decision to going to war?
That is a harder question, because in Vietnam, Sam Ervin always stood firmly behind President Johnson and President Nixon and always said that he believed that the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution was constitutional. In foreign policy, Sam Ervin was a hawk, and I believe he probably would have supported it. However, he would have been more concerned with the domestic implications of the war on terror that derive from those foreign policy decisions.
Rufus Edmiston, do you think?
As Carl said, he was very concerned about Vietnam. He thought it was a horrible mistake that we got in there. But as you know, he kept saying, "Well, we're in there. We ought to let the generals win the war." He thought that there was too much civilian interference in that war, and he spent literally months talking to every single soul from North Carolina who came up there to want to talk about how horrible they thought the Vietnam War was. But I think today, as Carl said, he would have said, yes, I'll support my president. But he would have said, right now, if you're not going to do something about the stabilizing the country, get out of there.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking with Rufus Edmiston and Carl Campbell about Sam Ervin this hour. Thank you so much both for being with us today.
Oh, thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Carl Campbell is Assistant Professor of History at Appalachian State University, an expert on Watergate and Senator Sam Ervin, and he has a biography that should be coming out. And Rufus Edmiston was Deputy Chief Counsel for the Senate Watergate Committee and an aide to Sam Ervin. He is a former North Carolina Attorney General and former North Carolina Secretary of State. And some of the audio we heard in our program today was taken from the PBS documentary Watergate Plus 30. Just ahead, we have a beloved John Irving novel, has its American stage debut. Playmakers Theater in Chapel Hill gives voice to A Prayer for Owen Meany. And let's go out hearing a little bit of Senator Sam singing If I Had a Hammer.
If I had a hammer, I'd hammer in the morning. I'd hammer in the evening all over the land. I'd hammer out danger. I'd hammer out a warning. I'd hammer out love between my brothers and my sisters all over this land. If I had a bell, I'd ring it in the morning. I'd ring it in the evening all over this land. I'd ring out danger. I'd ring out a warning. I'd ring out love between my brothers and my sisters all over this land. If I had a song, I'd sing it in the morning. I'd sing it in the evening all over this land. I'd sing out danger. I'd sing out a warning. I'd sing out love between my brothers and my sisters all over this land. Well, I got a hammer, and I've got a bell, and I've got a song all over this land.